Welcome to Studio Tulsa. I'm John Schumann with Medical Monday. Those of us that enter the field of medicine take on large commitments. Years of school, exams, long hospital nights, and tremendous personal and financial costs. What kind of toll does it take? According to my guest today, Dr. Pamela Weibel, a family doctor based in Eugene, Oregon, the profession takes a tremendous and largely unseen toll that affects doctors and patients alike. Quoting literature showing that half of doctors suffer from symptoms of burnout, Weibel has become a leading spokesperson decrying the rate of physician suicide, a rate that she quotes as 2 to 3 times higher than the average rate of suicide. Physicians live in a culture that typically refuses to acknowledge our own vulnerabilities. We are reluctant to seek help, and indeed, the stigma attached to depression, anxiety, and other forms of mental illness keeps this issue in the shadows. Weibel is an avid blogger, public speaker, and author of the book Physician Suicide Letters. She's also the subject of an upcoming documentary called Do No Harm that just completed a successful Kickstarter campaign. And she's my guest today on Studio Tulsa Medical Monday. Pamela Weibel, welcome to Medical Monday. Tell us, how serious of an issue is physician suicide?
It's a huge issue, actually. It impacts a lot of people. Approximately 1 million patients in the United States every year lose their physicians to suicide.
Wow. Has this been going on for a long time?
We've known of the high physician suicide rate since 1858 in England, and it's 158 years later, and surprisingly, very little has been done to actually prevent physician suicide.
I think there's high rates of burnout and mental health problems, especially in like the psychiatric field, for example, psychiatry. But are there other specific fields that you see high rates of burnout and depression and suicide, or is it across the profession?
It is across the profession, and there's certain specialties that are much higher risk. For example, anesthesiologists, just because they have access to such great drugs, you know, for ending it all. And if you have untreated mental health issues and you're standing around all these injectables that could put you out of pain, you know, obviously that's something that goes through physicians' minds. But I think it crosses all specialties, and a lot of physicians are having what I call suicidal daydreams while they're at work. Literally, they are jealous of their hospice patient. They're wishing they could switch places with the person that's terminal in the bed in front of them. You know, because they're just so miserable and they've not been able to get mental health care. And just to kind of backtrack a little bit, when you use the term burnout, I have a real problem with that term when it's used to describe physicians, because it's a victim blaming and shaming term that makes the individual feel defective. And when you have more than 50% of a population of physicians who are experiencing quote-unquote burnout, it's really not an individual issue. It's a systems issue. It's an inhumane work environment that's full of human rights violations. And these people are suffering, yet they, you know, kind of have to put on the white coat and the little smile on their face and pretend like everything's fine, you know, because that's their job, is to help other people. So, yeah, it's totally covered up. And it's a really serious issue that has consequences for patients and physicians.
There's a lot to unpack there, but you said 1 million patients a year are affected by the loss of their personal
physician. And that's not even counting the physicians who are just shells of their former selves, kind of living lives of silent desperation with depression, PTSD, and all the other issues that would get in the way of bonding with a patient and actually helping the person in front of you. It's very hard to give to patients what we have never received as medical students or physicians.
Well, Pamela, the way that I came across, you know, essentially you and what you do is there's a very popular in the field blog called Kevin MD, and we've actually had him on this program. Kevin Poe is the founder of curator of that blog, and it's really a place for physicians to talk about the profession. And often there are, I mean, either the posts themselves are across the gamut, but then you see a lot of commenters, and I'm always struck by the comments. And that, you know, people say you should never read the comments on blogs, but there definitely seems to be some very unhappy physicians who self-identify as physicians who are writing comments on that blog. But you are frequently posted there or reposted there, and almost any time you write a post on Kevin MD, it becomes the top post of the week or the month or the year with thousands and thousands of views and hits and hundreds of comments. So clearly you're onto something. I'm struck by something you said, that 50% of all doctors are feeling this, whatever we want to call it, if put it in quotes, burnout. I mean, how do we know that number?
Yeah, over 50% of physicians are feeling emotional distress or various degrees of mental health issues, right? So these are studies have revealed this, that they are unable to connect well with other people because they're so wounded themselves. They are, you know, having depression. I think they found in a recent study of medical students that 10% are suicidal or have been suicidal recently. And that was just done last year. And so if you just extrapolate from that kind of tragic statistic there, you can only imagine, like, how many more are depressed or kind of under the radar, not admitting that they're having issues, because we have to be strong. We're not allowed to show our true selves, to be vulnerable. We're supposed to be professionally distant. We are absolutely dehumanized methodically in the medical education process. And this is the end result. You have people that are kind of not all the way there, not able to be human, which is dangerous for your health.
One thing that might be hard for our listeners to understand is, I mean, first of all, everyone is aware how hard it is to become a physician. You have to be an outstanding student. You have to go through, you know, university almost invariably, and then onto medical school the way we do it in the United States, and then usually a residency. So that's another, at a minimum, past college, that's another 7 years usually. So everyone's aware, that whether they know the specifics or not, that it's an arduous process. But by the same token, physicians are still accorded a lot of societal respect, and everybody knows physicians make, you know, if not the highest amount of money, not CEO money, but they certainly make a very, they're never going to starve, so they're making good money. So what do physicians have to be so unhappy about?
Well, there's certain things that money can never buy, which is peace of mind and mental health, you know, because when you have been tormented in a medical system that's kind of like military boot camp, that's full of hazing, bullying, sleep deprivation, I mean, these are people that are willing to do the work of becoming physicians. They're not slackers. They're not trying to you know, party on the weekends, and you know, they're reliable, hardworking people who are actually very sensitive and loving individuals when they come into medical school, but that is beaten out of them through the medical education process. And there's no amount of money you could reimburse somebody that would help them recover from some of this trauma. For example, my mother and I went to the same medical school. She graduated 50 years ago. I graduated 22, University of Texas Medical Branch in Galveston, Texas. And we went back for her 50th reunion, which was my 22nd. And I had not been back there in 22 years. I never really wanted to go back. It was a very traumatic experience for me. It kind of felt like going back to the scene of a crime where I lost my innocence, you know. And when we were driving there, we both felt sick, like we were going to throw up, and we almost had to stop on the side of the road. So this is 50 and 22 years later, the feelings just come back of the mistreatment. Now, when we got there, I'm very social, and I'm meeting all these other doctors, and there was a woman in front of me who had graduated 35 years before. She's a psychiatrist, I think retired. And she told us that, I mean, I asked her, you know, how are things going? Are you doing? We're standing there, you know, drinking wine, hanging out around the bar, and schmoozing with everyone, and she said that she had just went into the medical library, and as soon as she got through the doors, she started, you know, crying uncontrollably, and she just had no idea why, but, you know, reflecting on it, she lost 4 years of her life in this library, and the feelings, it's like PTSD, it's like flashbacks, it's lifelong trauma from a really flawed medical education process.
You're listening to Studio Tulsa. It's Medical Monday. I'm John Schumann, and I'm speaking with Pamela Weibel, who's a family doctor in Eugene, Oregon, who's become an advocate crying out about the epidemic of physician suicide. Also will be featured in the upcoming documentary currently called Do No Harm, which is on the topic of physician suicide. And Pamela, you talked about returning to your medical school with your mother, who had graduated there decades before you, and how that awakened really these past traumas. So, you know, again, for I think the lay public, this is something that is fairly unknown. the conception of medical schooling and residency as a period in which hazing typically occurs and the hierarchy. We see this on television, I guess, in some of the popular medical dramas where the seniors or the eminence greases, if you will, browbeat the youth. And so there's this culture where that's a rite of passage. But I think your work has demonstrated that this is something, both that this trauma that's inflicted in the training period goes on into the career, and that even though we might have a conception that the hazing ends, it never really does. Is that an accurate read of some of your writing?
That is accurate. In fact, the only thing that allows us to be trapped in such a dysfunctional healthcare system is that it's sustained on the backs of a disempowered physician population. You know, we have mental health issues as a result of our training, and that the precursor of which are these abused medical students. So it is a cycle. It's a cycle of abuse that begins often on day one of medical school, where these people are tormented, you know, teaching by terror. That's really not, in 2016, the way we should be dealing with other human beings. You know, teaching by public humiliation, fear tactics, terror. You know, you're already seeing in a hospital patients die. You're already having to tell families that their three-year-old died in a car accident, and having to tell mothers that, you know, sorry, your baby, this is a stillborn. You know, I mean, you're giving bad news, hearing people scream all day long. You certainly don't need your peers telling you you're an idiot and being up for 50 hours. You'd never get in a plane with a pilot that hadn't slept for 36 hours, was constipated, hypoglycemic, hadn't eaten, you know, and was told he was an idiot and might be suicidal. Would you ever get in a plane with a pilot who's been treated that way?
I certainly wouldn't want to.
But every day in America, people are laying down in ICUs and their ventilators are being controlled by people who have been absolutely tormented. And these are wonderful, brilliant, loving people. And it's just, it's infuriating to me.
So this is an indictment, really, of the medical education system. You make it clear that from the time of medical school onward, and it continues on into residency and well beyond. How do we change this culture, or what are the solutions? How could it be done more humanely when the culture and the tradition is so very strong?
Well, step one, as my therapist recommended to me, because I was working on solutions, I've been dedicating my life to this the last 4 years, she tapped me on the shoulder one day and she said, you know, you can't really solve a problem nobody knows exists. Okay? That's the first issue, is that we need public awareness. We need to increase public awareness and decrease professional denial around this problem. You have very injured people who are teaching at medical schools. They have something called Stockholm Syndrome, where they now feel like the way that they've been treated brutally in the past, tormented themselves, they feel like that's normal, and that, you know, that's how they apprenticed into this profession, so they feed that right back to the next generation of first-year medical students walking in with bright-eyed, bushy tails ready to, you know, heal the world, and they just get, you know, crushed. Their souls get crushed. In fact, I had a medical student write me last week, sent me an email that during their orientation in their medical school, the dean of academic affairs stood up and told everyone that he was there to crush their souls. That was the welcome to medical school talk.
And that wasn't tongue-in-cheek at all?
No, serious. And he says things like, I own you. He's a bully on the loose at a medical school. And you have these people who've been tormented themselves, who are bullies on the loose, who do not have proper access to, like, 2016 teaching methods. They haven't been, you know, we need to update our teaching methods. We need to rein in these people who are obviously injured with mental health issues and pull them away from teaching positions with students until they can get some help. We need to destigmatize mental health care so that we deal with it like kind of like dental health care, like everyone's on a brushing and flossing routine. Like, what are we doing for our mental health care in Western societies? Most people are not doing anything. They're just cruising along. But this is a high-risk profession where we see trauma every day and have to tell people that their husbands died and we're the last one to call off the code and the CPR failed. You know what? We are the ones that are immersed in this, and we are receiving no on-the-job debriefing, mental health care. And then you have, you know, as a result, kind of rats in a cage, all these tormented people piled on top of each other. They start acting out on each other. You know what I mean? They're acting out their own mental health conditions on each other, right?
Right. So you identify the problem, and the way that you've been doing that is broadcasts like this. You have written, you know, many, many blog posts. You are featured in a TEDMED talk, which TEDMED, for those uninitiated, is the TED Talks for the medical crowd, in which you tell some very incredibly tragic stories of you know, very bright-eyed and highly potential young people who feel there's no way out and end their lives. And then this documentary film, which I believe you were involved in a Kickstarter campaign that I think just ended. So can you tell us a little bit about that, the film?
Yeah, the Kickstarter campaign for the film, we just raised at a grassroots level over $100,000 from people who, once they realize this is an issue, you know, they want to donate, because there's not anyone who's immune from this. You know, you're going to be a patient one day. You need the person controlling your health care, your ventilator, to be well. You know, if you have a child in medical school, you don't want to have to worry that he might die by suicide. You know, if you're married to a physician, you don't want to have to think that your spouse is going to have PTSD the rest of their lives from what they've seen at work and they've never received treatment. So, I mean, everyone, including nurses and PAs, I mean, everyone in healthcare is impacted by this cycle of abuse. And so the first step is just public awareness and decreasing professional denial around this topic. And it really, really helps the victims to understand that they are not defective. This is what I hear over and over again, because I run almost like a suicide hotline for physicians and medical students out of my home. And inevitably, people call me and they tell me they think something's wrong with them, that they can't keep up with this inhumane pace with 50 patients a day, that they are crying themselves to sleep in their pillow at night. And I have to remind them those are the normal reactions that anyone would have to a sick medical education system and an inhumane working environment. And I'm just not exaggerating with this. If you read the United Nations Declaration of Human Rights, there's multiple articles in there that are broken every day in the way medical schools treat their medical students and the way hospitals and clinics treat their staff. The fact that you could be on call 7 days in a row and not leave the hospital, that's a human rights violation.
But we have seen, for example, the what's called the ACGME that accredits medical residency programs now mandates at least one day off in 7 to combat some of these realities.
And these are not enforced. The 80-hour work week restriction is not at all enforced, and residents know that if they stand up and complain that they were working 120 hours a week, because I hear on the phone, they call me and tell me, even though we have 80-hour work restriction, I've been in the hospital 120 hours this week. Of course, I'm not going to stand up as the only surgery resident and call my program out on this for two reasons. I don't want to get blackballed out of my program and get bad evaluations, and I don't want to have my program lose its accreditation so that I can't graduate as a surgeon. I'm already 3 years into a 5-year program.
One question that I have is that moving the needle in the right direction, at least the fact that these accrediting bodies are at least...
Oh, yeah, definitely. Okay. To talk about it and to start having laws, that's wonderful. They need to be enforced, right?
Yeah.
We are all moving in the right direction, no doubt about it, and we're moving very fast, especially when this film comes out and the public gets a dose of really what's going on behind the scenes. The public does not understand why their physicians are not bonding with them, why they're locked into these 5 and 10 minute office visits, why they're not getting the care they deserve from the person who's a really wonderful, good-natured, started with a, you know, bright hopes of healing the world on day one of medical school. You know, like, why is this not happening in these office visits? Well, you got to track back to how these people were treated in medical school. And once patients can understand that, they can break out of their adversarial relationship with the physician and become more, you know, have more empathy for these people who are really wonderful people who just wanted to help them. That was their only crime, right? They wanted to help humanity. And they went into this, and their souls were slaughtered, and their dreams were stolen. And they have, in large part, turned into these revenue-generating robots for big-box clinics, which is not in the physician's best interest or the patient's best interest.
You're listening to Studio Tulsa. It's Medical Monday. I'm John Schumann. My guest today is Pamela Weibel, who's a family doctor from Eugene, Oregon, who has devoted the last 4 years of her life to documenting and helping solve the problem of physician suicide that is rampant in the profession but very poorly communicated and documented. And Pamela, you're talking about robotic type environments in which doctors are pushed to, you know, churn out the patient visits. You have a solution that you really proffer, that you have sort of modeled your own medical practice after, something you call the ideal medical practice. Can you tell us a little bit about how you came up with that and what how it addresses some of these mental health issues for people in the profession?
Well, I was suicidal myself as a physician after 6 jobs in 10 years. You know, both my parents are physicians. I knew from an early age going to work with them that I love this profession. I love medicine. I love people. I saw medicine in its heyday by going to work with my parents. I knew what it was like to do house calls, to be a real doctor, right? And then when I graduated medical school in 1993 and I went through residency and finished in 96, I was essentially graduated and funneled into these assembly line big box medical clinics, and that was nothing like what I had imagined on my personal statement when I started. And so right there you have the first problem for most physicians. I'm not the only one experiencing this sort of turmoil. These people have $300,000 of debt, have spent like most of their life, including their 20s and 30s, when other people are having kids and partying and doing what normal 20 and 30 year olds do. Like, these people are in hospitals studying and in libraries so they can try to save people's lives. And at the very end, the promise of their autonomous medical practice or really being a true healer, they find out that they've been duped and that literally their only option is to take a job seeing 40 or 50 patients a day and 5-minute visits. You know, it's really an assault on your soul after all that time and education and commitment and debt to realize that you really are only valuable for your revenue generation on the production line of assembly line medicine for corporate medicine, which has very divergent ethics than you as a physician.
So, one obvious question would be, you know, why take that job if the conditions feel inhumane to the person, you know, in the box, so to speak, working? What, you know, why not open your own practice?
Well, they aren't exposed to doctors doing that. They are exposed to these salaried positions, and when they have $300,000 of debt, they somehow think that taking a salaried position is going to somehow help them pay off their debt sooner, which is actually a lie, because you get to keep more of your revenue when you work on your own. But to answer your original question, you know, how I pulled myself out of this, out of a complete state of misery and surrender when I was suicidal myself, I had an epiphany that if I'm so miserable because of my profession, and that's what was causing my suicidal thoughts, right? I wasn't having personal life problems or anything else. I was suicidal because I feel like I was born to be a healer on this planet, and my profession was not allowing me to do that, was not allowing me to really treat patients well and to be a doctor. They wanted a factory worker. So once I realized that, I had this epiphany that maybe I should put the end user in charge, maybe I should let the patients design their own clinic and I'll work for them. So I literally went out and had a series of town hall meetings over a 6-week period, invited my community in Eugene, Oregon to design their ideal clinic, to write my job description for me. I told them I'd do whatever they want as long as it was basically legal, and I got 100 pages of written testimony back, of which I was able to adopt 90%. We were open 1 month later without any outside funding, and I've been doing this for 12 years, and I'm having a blast.
Okay,
awesome.
So that's an amazing story. What is the ideal medical practice? What makes it so patient-focused? What was the 90%, I guess, that the community wanted that you were able to provide that sort of, you know, quote-unquote regular medical practice couldn't provide?
The number one thing that people wanted is a human-scale experience with a physician. They wanted a small, cozy office. They just wanted one person. They didn't want all these staff running around in circles. It's amazing to me what they really wanted. Nobody wanted, they could have said they wanted expensive equipment on every corner and thousands of dollars of investment. You know, they could have wanted something that I wouldn't be able to provide, right? In the end, in the most simple terms, what they wanted is me. They wanted the real me. They wanted eye contact. They wanted me to spend time with them. They wanted the full human experience of sitting with a doctor. I think it's best stated by this one participant who said, "I want to feel like I'm sitting in a living room with my best friend who happens to be my doctor." They are not getting that at big box clinics. They are getting bulletproof glass cafeteria-style waiting rooms and, you know, parking garages, you know, 6 stories tall. That is not what people want when they're sick. They want to go to somebody they trust who will spend time with them and actually, get this, answer their questions. You know what I mean? Like, they don't even get answers at these places. They pay an arm and a leg. They go through the hassle of waiting, phone trees, bulletproof glass, you know, like all this distrust. It's built on distrust and this factory model. It's actually based on like lean Toyota manufacturing principles, how they set these things up. So it's like they're creating these clinics like Toyota manufacturing plants, which is why people kind of feel like cars and physicians kind of feel like factory workers on an assembly line, you know?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, that's certainly true. You see lots of medical education offerings that involve quality assurance and talk about the Toyota manufacturing process. That is kind of interesting. Well, one question that springs up for me when you talk about your ideal medical practice is in terms of stress on the physician, if it's all you, Pamela, and there isn't these layers of staff and bulletproof glass, how do you manage it all when, you know, patients want that human contact? That makes a lot of sense to me, and it allows you to provide the care you were trained to give and want to give. But how do you, in a sense, bear it all? I mean, if it all comes down to you, doesn't that create an environment of stress or perhaps unmanageable expectations?
Not at all, because it goes back to having too many cooks in the kitchen is really stressful. It's much easier to make dinner if it's just you and maybe your spouse, you know, just kind of doing it together versus having 17 people in your kitchen all trying to like make the lentil stew with you. You know what I mean? And that's what it feels like at these clinics. You have a very simple thing that people need, which is maybe they need treatment for their ingrown toenail. I gave this example recently. The big problem in outpatient primary care is that we're holding primary care hostage to a tertiary care delivery model. And what I mean by that is tertiary care is like catastrophic, you know, you need a big hospital, like a lung transplant would be something that's tertiary care requiring, right? So if you need a lung transplant, you do need a 5-story hospital, and you need a helipad, and you need a team, and you need like tons of people and expensive equipment, and you need insurance, you know, because that's going to be $500,000. You know, you need all that, right? But for an ingrown toenail, you don't need a helipad, you don't need a 5-story hospital, you don't need a team. In fact, like any more people in the room besides me and a pair of scissors in the patient's toe is getting in the way. So you've got to remove, you got a too many cooks in the kitchen situation. So you got to remove all those people. And then what happens is you're working at a humane pace, kind of like what my patients suggested that I do. So instead, it's like parenting. It would be really hard to parent 3,000 people, you know, which is the average panel in some practices for physicians. They're taking care of 3,000 patients, right? But if I just have 500, you know, maybe if another way of looking at it is, you know, instead of 20 kids, you know, I just have 2. I'd probably be a much better parent to 2 people or to like 500 patients versus 3,000.
Do we know when the film will be coming out?
The film will be completed at the end of this year, and it should be out next year, hopefully submitted into like Sundance Film Festival and other festivals. So if people are interested in seeing the film trailer or donating to the film, you just go to donoharmfilm.com. It's really exciting. I'm absolutely thrilled that we are bringing this information out to the public because, you know, we're never going to solve it otherwise.
Well, Pamela Weibel, thank you for bringing this this horrible problem to our attention, and we'll certainly be looking for the film when it comes out.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Pamela Weibel is a family doctor in Eugene, Oregon. She's been a TEDMed speaker and is the subject of the upcoming documentary on physician suicide called Do No Harm. Well, that's our show for today. Studio Tulsa Medical Monday is produced and edited by Scott Gregory. The views of our guests and commentators are their own and do not necessarily reflect those of KWGS or the University of Tulsa. For Studio Tulsa, I'm John Schumann with Medical Monday. Thanks for listening.